Slick rubbed his eyes.
Because, I don't know, because he's... Look, Gentry, she's saying it'll maybe kill the poor bastard you try to tap in, you hear that?
L.F., Gentry said.
I heard that.
He put the jumpers between his teeth and began to fiddle with one of the connections on the featureless slab above the sleeper's head. His hands had stopped shaking.
Shit,
Cherry said and gnawed at a knuckle. The connection came away in Gentry's hand. He whipped the jumper into place with his other hand and began to tighten the connection. He smiled around the remaining jumper.
Fuck this, Cherry said. I'm out of here.
But she didn't move. The man on the stretcher grunted once, softly. The sound made the hairs stand up on Slick's arms. The second connection came loose. Gentry inserted the other splitter and began to retighten the fitting. Cherry went quickly to the foot of the stretcher, knelt to check the readout.
He felt it,
she said, looking up at Gentry.
But his signs look okay.
Gentry turned to his consoles. Slick watched as he jacked the jumpers into position. Maybe, he thought, it was going to work out. Gentry would crash soon, and they'd have to leave the stretcher up here until he could get Little Bird and Cherry to help him get it back across the catwalk. But Gentry was just so crazy. Probably he should try to get the drugs back, or some of them anyway, get things back to normal.
I can only believe, Gentry said, that this was predetermined, prefigured by the form of my previous work. I wouldn't pretend to understand how that might be, but ours is not to question why, is it, Slick Henry?
He tapped out a sequence on one of his keyboards.
Have you ever considered the relationship of clinical paranoia to the phenomenon of religious conversion?
What's he talking about?
Cherry asked. Slick glumly shook his head. If he said anything, it would only encourage Gentry's craziness. Now Gentry went to the big display unit, the projection table.
There are worlds within worlds, he said. Macrocosm, microcosm. We carried an entire universe across the bridge tonight. And that which is above is like that below. It was obvious, of course, that such things must exist, but I'd not dared to hope.
He glanced coyly back at them over a black beaded shoulder.
And now, he said, we'll see the shape of the little universe our guests gone voyaging in. And in that form, Slick Henry, I'll see.
He touched the power stud at the edge of the hollow table and screamed. Chapter 14 Toys.
"As a lovely thing," Petal said, touching a rosewood cube the size of Kumiko's head. "Battle of Britain."
Light shimmered above it, and when Kumiko leaned forward, she saw that tiny aircraft looped and dived in slow motion above a gray, petri smear of London.
"They worked it up from war films," he said. "Gun sight cameras."
She peered in at almost microscopic flashes of anti-aircraft fire from the Thames estuary.
"Did it for the centenary."
They were in Swain's billiard room, ground floor rear, number 16. There was a faint mustiness, an echo of pub smell. The overall tidiness of Swain's establishment was tempered here by genteel dilapidation. There were armchairs covered in scuffed leather, pieces of heavy dark furniture, the dull green field of the billiard table. The black steel rack stacked with entertainment gear had caused Petal to bring her here, before tea, shuffling along in his seam-sprung moleskin slippers, to demonstrate available toys.
Which war was this?
Last but one, he said, moving on to a similar but larger unit that offered holograms of two Thai boxing girls. One's calloused soul smacked against the other's lean brown belly, tensed to take the blow. He touched a stud and the projections vanished. Kumiko glanced back at the Battle of Britain and its burning nets.
All sorts of sporting fish,
Petal said, opening a fitted pigskin case that held hundreds of the recordings. He demonstrated half a dozen other pieces of equipment, then scratched his stubbled head while he searched for a Japanese video news channel. He found it finally, but couldn't cut out the automatic translation program. He watched with her as a cadre of Ono Sendai executive trainees effaced themselves in a tearful graduation ceremony.
What's all that, then?
He asked.
They are demonstrating loyalty to the Zaibatsu.
Right, he said. He gave the video unit a swipe with his feather duster.
Tea time soon.
He left the room. Kumiko shut off the audio. Sally Shears had been absent at breakfast, as had Swain. Moss-green curtains concealed another set of tall windows, opening onto the same garden. She looked out at a sundial sheathed in snow, then let the curtain fall back. The silent wall screen flashed Tokyo accident images, foil-clad medics sawing limp victims from a tangle of impacted steel. A top-heavy Victorian cabinet stood against the far wall on carved feet resembling pineapples. The keyhole, trimmed with an inlaid diamond of yellowed ivory, was empty, and when she tried the doors, they opened, exhaling a chemical odor of ancient polish. She stared at the black-and-white mandala at the rear of the cabinet until it became what it was, a dartboard. The glossy wood behind it was pocked and pricked. Some players had missed the board entirely, she decided. The lower half of the cabinet offered a number of drawers, each with a small brass pull and miniature ivory-trimmed keyhole. She knelt in front of these, glanced back toward the doorway, wall screen showing the lips of a Shinjuku cabaret singer, and drew the upper right drawer out as quietly as possible. It was filled with darts, loose and in leather wallets. She closed the drawer and opened the one to its left. A dead moth and a rusted screw. There was a single wide drawer below the first two. It stuck as she opened it and made a sound. She looked back again. Stock footage of Fuji Electric's logo, illuminating Tokyo Bay. But there was no sign of Petal. She spent several minutes leafing through a pornographic magazine with Japanese text, which seemed to have mainly to do with the art of knots. Under this was a dusty-looking jacket made of black waxed cotton, and a gray plastic case with Walter molded across its lid in raised letters. The pistol itself was cold and heavy. She could see her face in the blue metal when she lifted it from its fitted bed of foam. She'd never handled a gun before. The gray plastic grip seemed enormous. She put it back into the case and scanned the Japanese section in a folder of multilingual instructions. It was an air gun. You pumped the lever below the barrel. It fired very small pellets of lead. Another toy. She replaced the contents of the drawer and closed it. The remaining drawers were empty. she closed the cabinet door and returned to the Battle of Britain.
"No," Petal said. "Sorry, but it won't do."
He was spreading Devon cream on a crumpet, the heavy Victorian butter knife like a child's toy in his thick fingers.
"Try the cream,"
he said, lowering his massive head and regarding her blandly over the tops of his glasses. Kumiko wiped a shred of marmalade from her upper lip with a linen napkin.
"Do you imagine I'll try to run away?"
"Run away? Are you considering that? Running away?"
He ate his crumpet, chewing stolidly, and glanced out into the garden, where fresh snow was falling.
"No," she said. "I have no intention of running away."
"Good," he said, and took another bite.
"Am I in danger in the street?"
"Lord, no,"
he said, with a sort of determined cheeriness.
"You're safe as houses."
"I want to go out."
"No."
"But I go out with Sally."
"Yes," he said, "and she's a nasty piece of work, your Sally."
"I don't know this idiom."
"No going out alone. That's in our brief with your father, understand? You're fine out with Sally, but she isn't here. Nobody's liable to give you bother in any case, but why take chances? Now, I'd be happy, you see, delighted to take you out. Only I'm on duty here in case Swain has callers, so I can't. It's a shame, really it is."
He looked so genuinely unhappy that she considered relenting.
"Toast you another?"
he asked, gesturing toward her plate.
"No, thank you."
She put down her napkin.
"It was very good,"
she added.
"Next time you should try the cream," he said. "Couldn't get it after the war. Rain blew in from Germany and the cows weren't right."
"Is Swain here now, Petal?"
"No."
"I never see him."
"Out and about. Business. There's cycles to it. Soon enough, they'll all be calling here. And he'll be holding court again."
"Who, Petal?"
"Business types, you'd say."
"Kuromaku,"
she said.
"Sorry?"
"Nothing,"
she said. She spent the afternoon alone in the billiard room, curled in a leather armchair, watching snow fall in the garden and the sundial become a featureless white upright. She pictured her mother there, wrapped in dark furs, alone in the garden as the snow fell, a princess ballerina who drowned herself in the night waters of Sumida. She stood up, chilled, and went around the billiard table to the marble hearth, where gas flame hissed softly beneath coals that could never be consumed.
Chapter 15. The Silver Walks.
She'd had this friend in Cleveland, Lynette, who'd taught her lots of things. How to get out of a car fast if a trick tried to lock the doors on you. How to act when you went to make a buy. Lynette was a little older, and mainly used Wiz, she said, to move the down around, being frequently downed out on anything from endorphin analogs to plain old Tennessee opium. Otherwise, she said, she'd just sit there 12 hours in front of the vid, watching any kind of shit at all. When the Wiz added mobility to the warm invulnerability of a good down, she said, you really had something. But Mona had noticed that people who were seriously into downs spent a lot of time throwing up. And she couldn't see why anybody would watch a vid when they could stim just as easy.
Lynette said Simstim was just more of what she wanted out of. She had Lynette in her mind because Lynette used to give her advice sometimes, like how to turn a bad night around. Tonight, she thought, Lynette would tell her to look for a bar and some company. She still had some money left from her last night's work in Florida, so it was a matter of finding a place that took cash. She hit it right, first try. A good sign. Down a narrow flight of concrete stairs and into a smoky buzz of conversation and the familiar muted thump of Shabu's white diamonds. No place for suits. But it wasn't what the pimps in Cleveland called a spot either. She was no way interested in drinking in any spot, not tonight. Somebody got up from the bar to leave just as she came in, so she nipped over quick and got a stool with the plastic still warm. Her second sign. The bartender pursed his lips and nodded when she showed him one of her bills. So she told him to get her a shot of bourbon and a beer on the side, which was what Eddie always got if he was paying for it himself. If somebody else was paying, he'd order mixed drinks the bartender didn't know how to make, then spend a long time explaining exactly how you made the thing. Then he'd drink it and bitch about how it wasn't as good as the ones they made in L.A. or Singapore or some other place she knew he'd never been. The bourbon here was weird, sort of sour but real good once you got it down. She said that to the bartender, who asked her where she usually drank bourbon. She told him Cleveland, and he nodded. That was eth and some shit supposed to remind you of bourbon, he said. When he told her how much of her money was left, she figured out this sprawl bourbon was expensive stuff. It was doing its job, though, taking the bad edge off. So she drank the rest and started in on her beer. Lynette liked bars, but she never drank, just Coke or something. Mona always remembered one day she'd done two crystals at the same time, what Lynette called a two-rock hit, and she'd heard this voice in her skull say, just as clear as that, like it was somebody right in the room. It's moving so fast, it's standing still. And Lynette, who'd dissolved a matchhead of Memphis Black in a cup of Chinese tea about an hour before, did half a crystal herself, and then they'd gone out walking, just ghosting the rainy streets together, in what felt to Mona like some perfect harmony where you didn't need to talk. And that voice had been right. There was no jangle to the rush, no tight-jawed jitter. Just this sense of something, maybe Mona herself, expanding out from a still center. And they'd found a park, flat lawns, flooded with silver puddles, and gone all around the paths, and Mona had a name for that memory. The Silver Walks. And sometime after that, Lynette was just gone. Nobody saw her anymore. And some people said she'd gone to California, some people said Japan, and some people said she'd OD'd and gotten tossed out a window, what Eddie called a dry dive. But that wasn't the kind of thing Mona wanted to think about. So she sat up straight and looked around, and yeah, this was a good place. Small enough that people were kind of crowded in, but sometimes that was okay. It was what Eddie called an art crowd. People who had some money and dressed sort of like they didn't. Except their clothes fit right, and you knew they'd bought them new. There was a vid behind the bar, up over the bottles, and then she saw Angie there, looking square into the camera and saying something. But they had the sound down too low to hear over the crowd. Then there was a shot from up in the air, looking down on a row of houses that sat right at the edge of a beach, And then Angie was back, laughing and shaking her hair and giving the camera that half-sad grin.
"Hey," she said to the bartender. "There's Angie."
"Who?"
"Angie," Mona said, pointing up at the screen.
"Yeah," he said. "She's on some designer shit and decides to kick. So she goes to South America or somewhere and pays them a few mil to clean up her act for her."
"She can't be on shit."
The bartender looked at her.
"Whatever."
"But how come she'd even start doing anything? I mean, she's Angie, right? Goes with the territory."
"But look at her," she protested. "She looks so good."
But Angie was gone, replaced by a black tennis player.
"You think that's her? That's a talking head."
"Head?"
"Like a puppet," a voice behind her said. And she swung around far enough to see a ruff of sandy hair and a loose white grin.
"Puppet,"
and held up his hand, wiggling thumb and fingers. "You know." She felt the bartender drop the exchange, moving off down the bar. The white grin widened. "So she doesn't have to do all that stuff herself, right?" She smiled back. Cute one. Smart eyes. And a secret halo flashing her just the signal she wanted to read. No suit trick. Kinda skinny. She could like that tonight. And the loose look of fun around his mouth, set strange against the bright, smart eyes. "Michael."
"Huh?"
"My name, Michael."
"Oh, Mona, I'm Mona."
"Where you from, Mona?"
"Florida."
And wouldn't Lynette just tell her, go for it? Eddie hated art crowd people. They weren't buying what he was selling. He'd have hated Michael more because Michael had a job and this loft in a co-op building, or anyway, he said it was a loft. But when they got there, it was smaller than Mona thought a loft was supposed to be. The building was old, a factory or something. Some of the walls were sandblasted brick, and the ceilings were wood and timbers. But all of it had been chopped up into places like Michael's. A room not much bigger than the one back at the hotel, with a sleeping space off one side, and a kitchen and bath off the other. It was on the top floor, though, so the ceiling was mostly skylight. Maybe that made it a loft. There was a horizontal red paper shade below the skylight, hooked up to strings and pulleys, like a big kite. The place was kinda messy, but the stuff that was scattered around was all new. Some skinny white wire chairs, strung with loops of clear plastic to sit on, a stack of entertainment modules, a workstation, and a silver leather couch. They started out on the couch, but she didn't like the way her skin stuck to it, so they moved over to the bed, back in its alcove. That was when she saw the recording gear, stim stuff, on white shelves on the wall. But the whiz had kicked in again, and anyway, if you've decided to go for it, you might as well. He got her into the pickup, a black rubber collar with trode-tipped fingers pressing the base of her skull. Wireless. She knew that was expensive. While he was getting his own set on and checking the gear on the walls, he talked about his job, how he worked for a company in Memphis that thought up new names for companies. Right now, he was trying to think of one for a company called Cathode Cafe. They needed bad, he said, and laughed. But then he said it wasn't easy, because there were so many companies already that the good names had been used up. He had a computer that knew all the names of all the companies, and another one that made up words you can use for names, and another one that checked if the made-up words meant dickhead or something in Chinese or Swedish. But the company he worked for didn't just sell names. They sold what he called image. So he had to work with a bunch of other people to make sure the name he came up with fit the rest of the package. Then he got into bed with her, and it wasn't really great, like the fun was gone, and she might as well have been with a trick.
How she just lay there thinking he was recording it all so he could play it back when he wanted, and how many others did he have in there anyway? So she lay there beside him, afterward listening to him breathe, until the whiz started turning tight little circles down on the floor of her skull, flipping her the same sequence of unconnected images over and over. The plastic bag she'd kept her things in down in Florida, with its twist of wire to keep the bugs out. The old man sitting at the chipboard table, peeling a potato with a butcher knife worn down to a nub about as long as her thumb. A krill place in Cleveland that was shaped like a shrimp or something. The plates of its arched back bent from sheet metal and clear plastic, painted pink and orange. The preacher she'd seen when she'd gone to get her new clothes, him and his pale fuzzy Jesus. Each time the preacher came around, he was about to say something, but he never did. She knew it wouldn't stop unless she got up and got her mind onto something else. She crawled off the bed and stood there looking at Michael and the gray glow from the skylight. Rapture. Rapture's coming. So she went out into the room and pulled her dress on because she was cold. She sat on the silver couch. The red shade turned the gray of the skylight pink as it got lighter outside. She wondered what a place like this cost. Now that she couldn't see him, she had trouble remembering what he looked like. Well, she thought, he won't have any trouble remembering me. But thinking that made her feel hit or hurt or jerked around, like she wished she'd stayed at the hotel and stimmed Angie. The gray-pink light was filling up the room, pooling, starting to curdle at the edges. Something about it reminded her of Lynette and the stories that she'd OD'd. Sometimes people OD'd in other people's places, and the easiest thing was just to toss them out the window, so the cops couldn't tell where they came from. But she wasn't going to think about that. So she went into the kitchen and looked through the fridge and the cabinets. There was a bag of coffee beans in the freezer, but coffee gave you the shakes on Whiz. There were a lot of little foil packets with Japanese labels, freeze-dried stuff. She found a package of tea bags and tore the seal from one of the bottles of water in the fridge. She put some of the water in a pan and fiddled with the cooker until she got it to heat up. The elements were white circles printed on the black countertop. You put the pan in the center of a circle and touched a red dot printed beside it. When the water was hot, she tossed one of the tea bags in and moved the pan off the element. She leaned over the pan, inhaling herb-scented steam. She never forgot how Eddie looked when he wasn't around. Maybe he wasn't much, but whatever he was there. You have to have one face around that doesn't change. But thinking about Eddie now maybe wasn't such a good idea either. Pretty soon the crash would come on, and before then, she'd have to figure out a way to get back to the hotel. And suddenly it seemed like everything was too complicated, too many things to do, angles to figure, and that was the crash. When you had to start worrying about putting the day side together again. She didn't think Pryor was going to let Eddie hit her, though, because whatever he wanted had something to do with her looks. She turned around to get a cup. Pryor was there in a black coat. She heard her throat make a weird little noise all by itself. She'd seen things before, crashing on Whiz. If you looked at them hard enough, they went away. She tried it on Pryor, but it didn't work. He just stood there with a kind of plastic gun in his hand, not pointing it at her, just holding it. He was wearing gloves, like the ones Gerald had worn for the examination. He didn't look mad, but for once he wasn't smiling. And for a long time he didn't say anything at all, and Mona didn't either.
Who's here?
Like you'd ask at a party.
Michael? Where?
She pointed toward the sleeping space.
Get your shoes.
She walked past him, out of the kitchen, bending automatically to hook her underwear up from the carpet. Her shoes were by the couch. He followed and watched her put on her shoes. He still had the gun in his hand. With his other hand, he took Michael's leather jacket from the back of the couch and tossed it to her.
Put it on, he said. She did,
and tucked her underwear into one of its pockets. He picked up the torn white raincoat, wadded it into a ball, and put it into his coat pocket. Michael was snoring. Maybe he'd wake up soon and play it all back. With the gear he had, he didn't really need anybody there. In the corridor, she watched Pryor relock the door with a gray box. The gun was gone, but she hadn't seen him put it away. The box had a length of red fleck sticking out of it, with an ordinary-looking magnetic key on the end. Out in the street was cold. He took her down the block and opened the door of a little white three-wheeler. She got in. He got in the driver's side and peeled off the gloves. He started the car. She watched a blowing cloud reflected in the copper-mirrored side of a business tower.
"He'll think I stole it," she said,
looking down at the jacket.
Then the whiz flashed a final card, ragged cascade of neurons across her synapses. Cleveland in the rain, and a good feeling she had once. Walking. Silver.
Chapter 16. Filament in Strata.
"I'm your ideal audience, Hans,"
as the recording began for the second time.
"How could you have a more attentive viewer? And you did capture her, Hans. I know, because I dream her memories. I see how close you came."
"Yes,
you captured them. The journey out, the building of walls, the long spiral in. They were about walls, weren't they? The labyrinth of blood, of family. The maze hung against the void, saying, 'We are that within, that without is other. Here forever shall we dwell.' And the darkness was there from the beginning. You found it repeatedly in the eyes of Marie France, pinned it in a slow zoom against the shadowed orbits of the skull. Early on, she ceased to allow her image to be recorded. You worked with what you had. You justified her image, rotated her through planes of light, planes of shadow, generated models, mapped her skull with grids of neon. You used special programs to age her images according to statistical models, animation systems to bring your mature Marie France to life. You reduced her image to a vast but finite number of points and stirred them, let new forms emerge, chose those that seemed to speak to you. And then you went on to the others, to Ashpool and the daughter, whose face frames your work, its first and final image." The second viewing solidified their history for her, allowed her to slot Becker's shards along a timeline that began with the marriage of Tessier and Ashpool, a union commented upon in its day, primarily in the media of corporate finance. Each was heir to a more than modest empire. Tessier, to a family fortune founded on 9 basic patents in applied biochemistry, and Ashpool to the great Melbourne-based engineering firm that bore his father's name. It was marriage as merger, to the journalists, though the resulting corporate entity was viewed by most as ungainly, a chimera with 2 wildly dissimilar heads. But it was possible then, in photographs of Ashpool, to see the boredom vanish, and in its place, a complete surety of purpose. The effect was unflattering, indeed frightening. The hard, beautiful face grew harder still, merciless in its intent. Within a year of his marriage to Marie France Tessier, Ashpool had divested himself of 90% of his firm's holdings, reinvesting in orbital properties and shuttle utilities, and the fruit of the living union, 2 children, brother and sister, were being brought to term by surrogates in their mother's Biarritz villa. Tessier Ashpool ascended to High Orbit's archipelago to find the ecliptic sparsely marked with military stations and the first automated factories of the cartels. And here they began to build. Their combined wealth initially would barely have matched Ono Sendai's outlay for a single process module of that multinational's orbital semiconductor operation. But Marie-France demonstrated an unexpected entrepreneurial flair, establishing a highly profitable data haven serving the needs of less reputable sectors of the international banking community. This, in turn, generated links with the banks themselves and with their clients. Ashpool borrowed heavily, and the wall of lunar concrete that would be Freeside grew and curved, enclosing its creators. When war came, Tessier Ashpool were behind that wall. They watched Bonn flash and die, and Belgrade. The construction of the spindle continued with only minor interruptions during those 3 weeks. Later, during the stunned and chaotic decade that followed, it would sometimes be more difficult. The children, Jean and Jane, were with them now. The villa at Biarritz, having gone to finance construction of a cryogenic storage facility for their home, the Villa Strelight. The first occupants of the vault were 10 pairs of cloned embryos. 2 Jean and 2 Jane, 3 Jean and 3 Jane. There were numerous laws forbidding or otherwise governing the artificial replication of an individual's genetic material. But there were also numerous questions of jurisdiction. She halted the replay and asked the house to return to the previous sequence. Photographs of another cryogenic storage unit, built by the Swiss manufacturers of the Tessier Ashpool vault. Becker's assumption of similarity had been correct, she knew. These circular doors of black glass, trimmed with chrome, were central images in the other's memory. Potent and totemic. The images ran forward again, into zero-gravity construction of structures on the spindle's inner surface, installation of a Lado Atchison solar energy system, the establishment of atmosphere and rotational gravity. Becker had found himself with an embarrassment of riches, hours of glossy documentation. His response was a savage, stuttering montage that sheared away the superficial lyricism of the original material, isolating the tense, exhausted faces of individual workers amid a hive-like frenzy of machinery. Freeside greened and bloomed in a fast-forward flutter of recorded dawns and synthetic sunsets, a lush, sealed land, jeweled with turquoise pools. Tessier and Ashpool emerged for the opening ceremonies, out of Straylight, their hidden compound at the spindle's tip, markedly uninterested as they surveyed the country they had built. Here Becker slowed and again began his obsessive analysis. This would be the last time Marie-France faced a camera. Becker explored the planes of her face in a tortured extended fugue, the movement of his images in exquisite counterpoise with the sinuous line of feedback that curved and whipped through the shifting static levels of a soundtrack. Angie called pause again, rose from the bed, went to the window. She felt an elation, an unexpected sense of strength and inner unity. She'd felt this way 7 years earlier, in New Jersey, learning that others knew the ones who came to her in dreams, called them the Loa, divine horsemen, named them and summoned them and bargained with them for favor. Even then, there had been confusion. Bobby had argued that L'Anglais Sue, who rode Beauvoir in the Umfor, and the L'Anglais Sue of the Matrix were separate entities, if, in fact, the former was an entity at all. "They've been doing that for 10,000 years, he'd say, dancing and getting crazy. But there's only been those things in cyberspace for 7-8 years. Bobby believed the old cowboys,
the ones he bought drinks for in the Gentleman Loser, whenever Angie's career took him to the Sprawl, who maintained that the Lowell were recent arrivals. The old cowboys looked back to a time when nerve and talent were the sole deciding factors in a console artist's career. Although Beauvoir would have argued that it required no less to deal with the Loa.
"But they come to me," she'd argued. "I don't need a deck."
"It's what you got in your head. What your daddy did."
Bobby had told her about a general consensus among the old cowboys, that there had been a day when things had changed, although there was disagreement as to how and when. When it changed, they called it. And Bobby had taken a disguised Angie to the Loser to listen to them, dogged by anxious net security men who weren't allowed past the door. The barring of the security men had impressed her more than the talk at the time. The Gentleman Loser had been a cowboy bar since the war that had seen the birth of the new technology, and the Sprawl offered no more exclusive criminal environment, though by the time of Angie's visit, that exclusivity had long included a certain assumption of retirement on the part of regulars. The hot kids no longer hustled in the Loser, but some of them came to listen. Now in the bedroom of the house at Malibu, Angie remembered them talking, their stories of when it changed, aware that some part of her was attempting to collate those memories, those stories, with her own history and that of Tessier Ashpool. Three Jane was the filament, Tessier Ashpool the strata. Her birth date officially listed as one with her 19 sibling clones. Becker's interrogation grew more heated still when 3 Jane was brought to term in yet another surrogate womb, delivered by cesarean section and Straylight surgery. The critics agreed. 3 Jane was Becker's trigger. With 3 Jane's birth, the focus of the documentary shifted subtly, exhibiting a new intensity, a heightening of obsession. A sense, more than one critic had said, of sin. 3 Jane became the focus, a seam of perverse gold through the granite of the family.
No, Angie thought. Silver, pale and moonstruck.
Examining a Chinese tourist's photograph of 3 Jane and two sisters beside the pool of a freeside hotel, Becker returns repeatedly to 3 Jane's eyes, the hollow of her collarbone, the fragility of her wrists. Physically, the sisters are identical, yet something informs 3 Jane, and Becker's quest for the nature of this information becomes the work's central thrust. Freeside prospers as the archipelago expands. Banking nexus, brothel, data haven, neutral territory for warring corporations. The spindle comes to play an increasingly complex role in high-orbit history. While Tessier Ashpool S.A. recedes behind yet another wall, this one composed of subsidiary corporations. Marie France's name surfaces briefly, in connection with a Geneva patent trial concerning certain advances in the field of artificial intelligence, and Tessier Ashpool's massive funding of research in this area is revealed for the first time. Once again, the family demonstrates its peculiar ability to fade from sight, entering another period of obscurity, one which will end with the death of Marie France. There would be persistent rumors of murder, but any attempt to investigate would founder on the family's wealth and isolation, the peculiar breadth and intricacy of their political and financial connections. Angie, screening Becker for the second time, knew the identity of Marie-France Tessier's murderer. At dawn, she made coffee in the unlit kitchen and sat watching the pale line of the surf.
Continuity. Hello, Angie. Do you know how to reach Hans Becker?
I have his agent's number in Paris.
Has he done anything since Antarctica?
Not that I know of.
And how long has that been?
5 years.
Thanks.
You're welcome, Angie.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, Angie.
Had Becker assumed that 3Jane was responsible for Ashpool's eventual death? He seemed to suggest it, in an oblique way.
Continuity.
Hello, Angie.
The folklore of console jockeys' continuity.
What do you know about that?
And what will Swift make of all this, she wondered.
What would you like to know, Angie?
When it changed.
The myth form is usually encountered in one or two modes. One mode assumes that the cyberspace matrix is inhabited, or perhaps visited, by entities whose characteristics correspond with the primary myth form of a hidden people. The other involves assumptions of omniscience, omnipotence, and incomprehensibility on the part of the matrix itself.
That the matrix is God?
In a manner of speaking. Although it would be more accurate in terms of the myth form to say that the matrix has a god. Since this being's omniscience and omnipotence are assumed to be limited to the matrix.
If it has limits, it isn't omnipotent.
Exactly. Notice that the myth form doesn't credit the being with immortality, as would ordinarily be the case in belief systems positing a supreme being, at least in terms of your particular culture. Cyberspace exists, insofar as it can be said to exist, by virtue of human agency.
Like you?
Yes.
She wandered into the living room, where the Louis XVI chairs were skeletal in the gray light, their carved legs like gilded bones.
If there were such a being, she said, you'd be a part of it, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Would you know?
Not necessarily.
Do you know?
No.
Do you rule out the possibility?
No.
Do you think this is a strange conversation, continuity? Her cheeks were wet with tears, although she hadn't felt them start.
No.
How do the stories about?
She hesitated, having almost said the Loa.
About things in the Matrix. How do they fit in to this supreme being idea?
They don't. Both are variants of when it changed. Both are of very recent origin.
How recent?
Approximately 15 years.
Chapter 17. Jump City. She woke with Sally's cool palm pressed to her mouth, the other hand gesturing for silence. The little lamps were on, the one set into the panels of gold-flecked mirror. One of her bags was open, on the giant bed, a neat little stack of clothing beside it. Sally tapped her index finger against closed lips, then gestured toward the case and the clothing. Kumiko slid from beneath the duvet and tugged on a sweater against the cold. She looked at Sally again and considered speaking. Whatever this was, she thought, a word might bring petal. She was dressed as Kumiko had last seen her, in the shearling jacket, her tartan scarf knotted beneath her chin. She repeated the gesture. Pack. Kumiko dressed quickly, then began to put the clothing into the case. Sally moved restlessly, silently around the room, opening drawers, closing them. She found Kumiko's passport, a black plastic slab embossed with a gold chrysanthemum, and hung it around Kumiko's neck on its black nylon cord. She vanished into the veneered cubicle and emerged with the suede bag that held Kumiko's toilet things. As Kumiko was sealing the case, the gilt and ivory telephone began to chime. Sally ignored it, took the suitcase from the bed, opened the door, took Kumiko's hand, and pulled her out into the darkened hallway. Releasing her hand, Sally closed the door behind them, muffling the phone and leaving them in total darkness. Kumiko let herself be guided into the lift. She knew it by its smell of oil and furniture polish, the rattle of the metal gate. Then they were descending. Petal was waiting for them in the bright white foyer, wrapped in an enormous faded flannel robe. He wore his decrepit slippers. His legs, below the robe's hem, were very white. He held a gun in his hands. A squat, thick thing, dull black. "Fucking hell," he said softly as he saw them there. "And what's this, then?"
"She's going with me," Sally said.
"That," said Petal, slowly, "is entirely impossible."
"Kumi," Sally said, her hand on Kumiko's back, guiding her out of the lift. "There's a car waiting."
"You can't do this," Petal said. But Kumiko sensed his confusion, his uncertainty.
"So fucking shoot me, Petal."
Petal lowered the gun. "It's Swain who'll fucking shoot me if you have your way."
"If he were here, he'd be in the same bind, wouldn't he?"
"Please," Petal said. "Don't."
"She'll be fine, not to worry. Open the door." "Sally," Kumiko said, "where are we going?"
"The sprawl." And woke again, huddled under Sally's shielding jacket, to the mild vibration of supersonic flight. She remembered the huge low car waiting in the crescent, floodlights leaping out from the facades of Swain's houses as she and Sally reached the pavement. Tick's sweaty face glimpsed through one of the car's windows, Sally heaving open a door and bundling her in, Tick cursing softly and steadily as the car accelerated. The complaint of the tires as he swung them too sharply into Kensington Park Road. Sally telling him to slow down, to let the car drive.
And there, in the car, she'd remembered returning the Mas Neotech unit to its hiding place behind the marble bust. Colin left behind with all his fox print poise, the elbows of his jacket worn like petal slippers. No more than what he was. A ghost.
40 minutes, Sally said now from the seat beside her.
"Good you got some sleep.
They'll bring us breakfast soon. Remember the name on your passport?"
"Good.
Now don't ask me any questions until I've had some coffee, okay?" Kumiko knew the sprawl from 1,000 stims. A fascination with the vast conurbation was a common feature of Japanese popular culture. She'd had a few preconceptions of England when she arrived there. Vague images of several famous structures, unfocused impressions of a society her own seemed to regard as quaint and stagnant. In her mother's stories, the princess ballerina discovered that the English, however admiring, couldn't afford to pay her to dance. London, so far, had run counter to her expectations, with its energy, its evident affluence, the Ginza bustle of its great shopping streets. She had many preconceptions of the sprawl, most of which were shattered within a few hours of arrival. But as she waited beside Sally in a line of other travelers, in a vast hollow customs hall whose ceiling struts rose away into darkness, a darkness broken at intervals by pale globes, globes circled, though it was winter, by clouds of insects, as though the building possessed its own discreet climate. It was the stim sprawl, she imagined, the sensual electric backdrop for the fast-forward lives of Angela Mitchell and Robin Lanier. Through customs, which consisted, in spite of the endless wait in line, of sliding her passport along a greasy-looking metal slot and out into a frantic concrete bay where driverless baggage carts plowed slowly through a crowd that milled and struggled for ground transportation. Someone took her bag, reached down and took it from her with an ease, a confidence that suggested he was meant to take it, that he was a functionary performing an accustomed task,
like the young women bowing welcome at the doors of Tokyo department stores. And Sally kicked him. Kicked him in the back of the knee, pivoting smoothly, like the Thai boxing girls in Swain's billiard room, snatching the bag before the back of his skull and the stained concrete met with an audible crack. Then Sally was pulling her. The crowd had closed over the prone figure, and the sudden, casual violence might have been a dream. Except that Sally was smiling for the first time since they'd left London. Feeling entirely dislocated now, Kumiko watched as Sally made a survey of available vehicles, quickly bribed a uniformed dispatcher, intimidated three other prospective fares, and chivied Kumiko into a pockmarked, slab-sided hovercraft, painted in diagonal bands of yellow and black. The passenger compartment was barren and remarkably uncomfortable-looking. The driver, if there was one, was invisible beyond a scrawled bulkhead of plastic armor. The nub of a video camera protruded where the bulkhead met the roof, and someone had drawn a crude figure there, a male torso, the camera its phallus. As Sally climbed in, slamming the door behind her, a speaker grated something in what Kumiko assumed was a dialect of English. "Manhattan," Sally said. She took a sheaf of paper currency from her jacket pocket and fanned it below the camera. The speaker made interrogatory noises. "Midtown. Tell you where when we get there." The cab's apron bag inflated. The light in the passenger compartment was extinguished, and they were on their way. Chapter 18. Jail Time. He was in Gentry's loft. He was watching Cherry do nurse things to Gentry. Cherry looked over at him from where she sat on the edge of Gentry's bed.
"How you doing, Slick?"
"Okay. I'm okay."
"Remember me asking you before?"
He was looking down at the face of the man Kid Africa called the Count. Cherry was fiddling with something on the stretcher superstructure. A bag of fluid, the color of oatmeal.
"How you feel, Slick?"
"Feel okay."
"You're not okay. You keep four?"
He was sitting on the floor of Gentry's loft. His face was wet. Cherry was kneeling beside him, close, her hands on his shoulders.
"You did time?"
He nodded.
"Chemopenal unit?"
"Yeah."
"Induced Korsakoff's?"
"He..."
"Episodes?" Cherry asked him.
He was sitting on the floor in Gentry's loft. Where was Gentry?
"You get episodes like this? Short-term memory goes?"
How did she know? Where was Gentry?
"What's the trigger?"
"What triggers the syndrome, Slick? What kicks you into jail time?" He was sitting on the floor in Gentry's loft, and Cherry was practically on top of him.
"Stress,"
he said, wondering how she knew about that.
"Where's Gentry?"
"I put him to bed."
"Why?"
"He collapsed. When he saw that thing."
"What thing?"
Cherry was pressing a pink derm against his wrist.
"Heavy trank," she said. "Maybe get you out of it."
"Out of what?"
She sighed. "Never mind."
He woke up in bed with Cherry Chesterfield. He had all his clothes on, everything but his jacket and his boots. The tip of his erect cock was trapped behind his belt buckle, pressing up against the warm denim over Cherry's ass.
"Don't get any ideas."
Winter light through the patchwork window and his breath white when he spoke.
"What happened? Why was it so cold in the room?"
He remembered Gentry's scream as the thing lunged for him. He sat up straight, fast.
"Easy," she said, rolling over. "Lie back. Don't know what it takes to set you off." What do you mean?
Lie back. Get under the covers. Wanna freeze?
He did as she said.
You were in jail, right? In a chemo-penal unit.
Yeah.
How'd you know?